Okay, so we got a good start last day, but I thought I would recap just so that we've got it all down. So we started by talking about strings. I made a point of saying that what I'm talking about or the theories that we're talking about are actually relativistic strings. And that means that if I want to characterize these strings, one of the things I have to give you is the tension, but there's not an independent tension and an energy density. And in our favorite particle physics units, where h bar and c are 1, I can write that tension as 1 over a length scale squared, and it's traditional to stick in a factor of 2 pi. And then that scale, the string scale here, that distance scale, you can think of as being the characteristic size of these strings as they float around in the space-time. The other thing I said is that there's a simple geometric action, by which I mean that if I have two loops, like here, they can come along, and when they touch, the ends can reconnect, and it can open up as a single string. So that's that's what this cartoon is supposed to show. That interaction, though, is governed by a dimensionless coupling constant, just like in ordinary field theories, or the typical field theories that we work with. And it's called G sub S, or G string. And so when I draw a diagram like this, I would associate a G substring with this region. The string then is sort of an excited state here. It propagates along. And then what happened is this loop, somewhere it intersected with itself. When it intersected, it recombined, or the edges rewired themselves, and then it fell apart into two loops. And so this is the time reverse of that process. And again, I'd have another G string there. And so a picture like this you might associate with the kind of things you've been writing in quantum field theory. You might think of that as analogous to a Feynman diagram, where two particles come in, they interact, some virtual particle propagates along for a while, and it decays then, and those guys wander off to infinity. To make this more precise, Polyakov introduced an idea of a path integral. So that what I'm doing here, very much in analogy to first quantized particles, is I just integrate over all possible configurations like this with some perhaps fixed boundary conditions representing the particles at infinity. And at the end of the day, what I said is that that amounts to, or this path integral reduces at the end of the day, to just a two-dimensional quantum field theory. It's a quantum field theory over the two-dimensional surface swept out by these strings. And what lives on that surface is nothing but d, the space-time dimension, number of massless scalars. And these were the things we called x mu, and they were functions of the coordinates on the world sheet. There was another idea that came, well, the main idea actually that came out of Polyakov's work, was the idea of a local scale invariance, or a decoupling of the metric on this surface. In fact, what he showed is that at least in a critical dimension, it didn't matter, essentially, or almost. We'll see that there's a fine print there that we have to worry about. But at first, broad brush, it doesn't matter even what metric I choose for this surface, what intrinsic metric I choose. That's associated with the decoupling of the conformal mode, or so you have word, we had words like local scale invariance, or this field theory is actually a conformal field theory. But in this particular problem, the critical dimension that we picked out was 26. And again, a buzzword that comes along with that, so the buzzword here was relativistic, the buzzword here is critical. So the string theories I'm going to be talking about are all critical string theories. You don't have to make this choice, but the string theory becomes more complicated if I tried to quantize this theory with d not equal to 26. And this, though, is the theory that we're going to be interested in. Okay. Then we continued on. I talked about there being a world sheet metric, and it really didn't matter. But there was a remnant of the existence of that metric in that its equations of motion had to be satisfied. And what that amounted to, because there was essentially no dynamics for the metric, there was a stress tensor. So this is like an Einstein equation, and so we get the stress tensor on one side of the equation, but there's no dynamics, there's no Einstein term over here, and so I just get zero. And so this becomes a constraint then on the allowed field configurations, or the allowed X configurations that are going to be physical in this theory. And there's actually this is a local constraint, it's TAB of sigma and tau, but a convenient way to organize it is in Fourier modes, and there's a whole story that I'm not telling you about a Virasoro algebra, and symbols that you typically see are LNs or LN tildes. The two constraints that I focused on were just the zero modes of this, and in particular, there's the zero mode of T tau tau, that's the energy density on the world sheet, and so that gives us the Hamiltonian. There was another constraint that gives us something interesting, or that we had to pay, I want you to pay attention to. Here, actually, I lied to you last day. I wrote T sigma sigma, I think. What it should have been is T sub tau sub sigma. If you remember, one of the properties of the stress tensor is it's traceless. And so if I wrote sigma sigma here, it would have just been equal to tau tau. And so this would have been the same constraint. But there's an off-diagonal term. It gives us an independent constraint. And so at the end of the day, what do the constraints, that those vanish when they act on the states, amount to? Well, the first one gives us something that looks like a dispersion relation in the space-time for the various states of our first quantized string. And so there's a zero mode contribution that came out to be p squared. And then I put everything else on the other side of the equation. There's some renormalization constant, or that was the zero energy contribution. So naively, this is infinite, and usually we just discard it altogether. Turns out that it plays a crucial role here, and there's an appropriate choice that leads to a consistent theory, which turns out to be that constant A is equal to minus 1. These guys, these n and n tilde, were like number operators. They weren't quite number operators because I normalized my alphas not quite to be creation annihilation operators. But it's traditional to still call them the number operators. So this had like alpha, it was a sum with an alpha minus n, alpha n. And this had the same with tildes in it. So it looks kind of like, an expression with annihilation operator, creation operator. This other constraint gave us something called level matching. And so I needed the same amount of excitations of oscillators in the right moving sector as in the left moving sector. And so that'll be a constraint that we impose on our states. So one can just go ahead and see what kinds of states. So we had some quantum field theory, and we can just look at the states. There's a ground state. Unfortunately, when we evaluate this, this vanishes, that vanishes. And we're just left with that term, but I said that it was minus 1. And so I have a state that effectively has a mass squared of minus 1 over LS squared. And so that's I wrote a symbol that, did I write an alpha prime in anywhere at point in last day's lecture? Well, it doesn't matter. That's LS squared. So LS squared is also called alpha prime sometimes. In any event, we have this embarrassing feature that for this particular theory, the ground state is a tachyon. And so it seems like when I think of this not as a two-dimensional quantum field theory, but as a theory of strings, there are tachyons propagating around in the space-time. So that's a bit of an embarrassment. The first excited state, what I do is I act with one of the alphas and one of the alpha tildes. And so there's two indices. These are space-time indices. So we can parameterize our various states by endowing it with some kind of polarization tensor. And in general, that's an arbitrary matrix, but we can break it up into irreducible representations. And what you get is an anti-symmetric part, and that state is often called the Cobb-Ramond state or the Cobb-Ramon field. It's an anti-symmetric tensor. There's a scalar, which is just the trait or something that has, well, when this is proportional to delta mu nu or eta mu nu, that scalar is usually called the dilaton. And then there's a symmetric traceless part of this. And that object, well, I've already given it the name. That's the graviton. That look, or it looks like a graviton. It's something symmetric, traceless, and most importantly, all of these states are massless. M squared or P squared is equal to zero for all of those states. We can continue that game. We can add more and more oscillators. And I should have given a label here. There's a minus. So I picked out the simplest or the lowest oscillator, the alpha minus ones and the alpha tilde minus one. I can continue adding more of those oscillators, or I can add alpha with higher indices. And you get more excited states. And for all of those, I get some kind of m squared that's positive. And it's a number times, again, the string scale, because or the string scale squared, because that appears there. So there's a whole plethora, then, of massive states in this theory as well. And then I should pause and ask if there are any questions. That had to do with the boundary conditions. When we chose, when I set this up, I wanted to talk about loops. And so I just decided that sigma ran from 0 to 2 pi. When I picked my wave functions, when I did the two-dimensional quantum field theory, we solved the equations of motion. They were plane waves, but we want them to be periodic on this circle. And so that limited the frequencies to be integers. And so, other questions? If not, then what we were doing at the end of last day's lectures is as well as the spectrum, which is characterized by the tension up there, I said these strings are going to interact. And so one way to approach that problem is to start studying in our two-dimensional quantum field theory, you know, the interactions. I can start studying diagrams like that I said were like Feynman diagrams, and I can see how the various modes interact and start, you know, looking at all of the all of the complications that come from that, from building up the S matrix. I also, though, said that there's another way you can approach this problem, which is we're going to generalize the two-dimensional world sheet action that appeared in the Polyakov integral, path integral. Implicitly there, when we originally talked about it, these strings were propagating around in just empty Minkowski space. And so there were all sorts of places where there were eta mu nus appearing in our formulas to contract up the indices on the x's over there. But it's natural to think that, if I have gravitons around, I might think about strings propagating around in a curve space time. And so it would seem that a natural thing to do is rather than contract up indices like mu nu here with just eta mu nu, I could introduce a curve space-time metric, g mu nu. When I say it's a curve space metric, the geometry depends on where we are. And so there are going to be implicitly x's hidden in this. This is now not just a matrix of constants, it's a matrix of functions of x. And so there are all sorts of complicated interactions in my two-dimensional quantum field theory now. The other thing that I've done here is I've reintroduced the world sheet metric, this HAB, to contract up these indices and to give a measure here. But as well as the graviton, we had other massless fields around, and so it turns out it's interesting to generalize it not just by curving the space-time, but by giving these fields interesting profiles. And it turns out that, you know, if The antisymmetric tensor has an interesting profile. There's a B mu nu, an antisymmetric tensor that's a function of x. I can contract that with a bunch of, well, these derivatives of x as well. And then what I said is I need something antisymmetric to contract up the remaining world sheet indices. And naturally, in two dimensions, we have the volume form. And so this is a natural term that we can write down on the world sheet. And the last one, turns out, takes this form here. So we had a scalar field. And we need to multiply that by something that has, it's a scalar. So we don't want it to have any indices, but we'd still like it to be the same dimension as these operators when I think of it as a quantum field theory. And the natural thing to write down, well, after a lot of guesswork, smart people figured out that the thing to write down here was the Ricci scalar of this particular metric that lives on the world sheet. And so, well, we're going to talk about that one as well a little bit later. But the key thing was that I went from a very simple two-dimensional quantum field theory, one where I just had, I didn't write the word free, but those were free massless scalar fields, to one where we've got all sorts of interactions hidden in these expressions that I've written down, because the G, the B, and the phi are all functions of X. A key property up here, though, is this scale invariance or conformal invariance. And so if I want to preserve that, what people do is they ask or they demand that the trace anomaly vanish. So what did that mean? It was something we saw, or I didn't actually show it. I claim that you can easily see in that first theory, if I calculate that TAB in the usual way, and then I just take the trace of it, that equation is just zero. There's nothing left. However, and that reflects this scale invariance. However, in a quantum theory, you can sometimes run into situations where there's a symmetry in the classical theory, but it's broken or it's not preserved by the quantum theory. And scale invariance is one of those symmetries where it happens all the time. And so if you ask what's the expectation value of the trace of the stress tensor in my quantum theory, in fact, typically you would find for a generic theory like this that the answer is not zero. What you would find is if this theory lives on a curved space-time, there'd be a term here proportional to the Ricci scalar. And in this theory, it's not just a constant times the Ricci scalar, but there's a complicated function of the x's that sits there. But what we're going to do is we're going to demand that, or what these smart people told us to do, is that we're going to demand that this conformal invariance be true. That's what picked out the critical dimension, and it's also crucial in, well, ending up with these massless fields and choosing that renormalization constant. And so we're just going to say, you know, well, there's some expression there, but we're going to demand that it's zero always. And so, well, I can't force that to be zero. If you choose different geometries, I'll get different answers here. But what I'll do is I'll demand that this coefficient be zero. And that turns out to be, well, that coefficient looks like this. It starts with a constant term, which is d minus 26. And so it tells us, again, to pick out that critical dimension. But then there's terms with lots of derivatives. And this becomes an expansion in this alpha prime. And so there are whole bunch of terms. Oh, there's that alpha prime again. So that's ls squared. And there, all of these terms have two derivatives, two space-time derivatives acting on various functions here. So this is like the Laplace or the D'Alembertian acting on that phi that appeared over there. And then there are other fields. You know, here, that's the Ricci scalar, but now of our space-time metric. This is the metric in the space-time. And so that looks kind of like an equation of motion if we demand that it's equal to zero. It's also an approximation in that, you know, I said this was an expansion. I start with a term that is just a constant. Then there's a term that's alpha prime times derivative squared. The next term, if I worked harder, I'd find that there's alpha prime squared stuff. But what that multiplies would have four derivatives. Say I'd have D'Alembertian squared, or two D'Alembertians acting on phi, or the square of that term. In any event, what we and then there's more. I mean, there's more terms here that are associated with this term and that term, and we want to set them all to zero. And then I said, though, a natural question is that this constraint seems to be giving us something that looks like an equation of motion, and so is there an action principle that gives rise to that? Of course, I know what the answer is, which is why I asked the question, but I stress that this looks like an equation of motion for these fields in the space-time. So we've gone from talking about two-dimensional quantum field theory to producing an equation of motion for these fields in the space-time. And the action I'm going to write down, then, is an action in the space-time. And so what we do, after a lot of hard work, actually, what people find is an expression like this. To make that all dimensionless, I mean, I'm doing an integral over my space-time. There's two derivatives over there, so this has some big dimension. I need to stick some kind of new coupling constant. This looks like a theory of gravity, and so it's natural to say that the coupling constant I need here should look something like Newton's constant. This looks like an action with an Einstein term. This looks like the action for Einstein gravity. This looks kind of like a kinetic term for a scalar field. I told you last day, but this H, what is that? That is a three-index tensor that's built out of the B, and it looks something like that. So this is like what an F mu nu is to the one form or the vector potential in Maxwell's equation. You know, I start with a four vector A mu, I take some derivatives of it, and I end up with an F mu nu. Here I start with a B mu nu, two indices, I end up with a field strength that has three indices. And actually, what you can check is that this object, all of the indices are anti-symmetric. And for people who like forms, the appropriate equation here is B is a two form. I take the exterior derivative to produce this three form here. And, well, we can call that, well, what I said was that's the field strength for this Cobb-Ramon field or this anti-symmetric tensor field. What else to say about that? One thing is, just as these equations, I said, were the first few terms in an expansion, in fact, an infinite expansion in higher powers of alpha prime and whatnot, this expression is also going to get lots of corrections. Where do I want to put the bracket? I could put the bracket here. There's going to be extra stuff. If I work harder, I can complete or extend those expansions there, and I'd expand this expansion here, and I'd have stuff again with one alpha prime but four derivatives. Here I've got two derivatives, here I go to four derivatives, but to make everything balance out, I stick in an alpha prime. Another thing that we really haven't talked about, but I'll get back to in a moment, Yeah, I'll say it now. So we had a coupling constant. I said that there's an analogy between these kinds of diagrams and Feynman diagrams. And this turns out to be a theory of quantum fields in the space-time. And so just like we have tree-level diagrams there, we also have loop diagrams. And so there can be quantum corrections to the equations of motion or to the action. And so I can also find loop corrections. Although I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself, but that formula is going to disappear. So I'll just write it there now. So there are also, in principle, there are also loop corrections. And these were just the coming from alpha prime corrections to the equations of motion, or sometimes these things are called beta functions. So I'll pause there. Are there any questions?
More factors of alpha prime. How would that look in that picture? Is it more legs or?
No. Well, that's another interesting thing to say. I mean, I think I said it last day, but here we started and we ended up with a spectrum. So these were just free particles that propagated around. Here I use that as motivation to do something here. But I said these particles also interact up there. And hidden in this are, in fact, interactions. So here's a Ricci scalar, and so that's a nonlinear functional of G. And in particular, if I think about G mu nu equals eta mu nu, so I'm close to flat space, but I add a small perturbation, which is h hat as opposed to h. So if I add a small perturbation here, this is some kind of nonlinear expression. And so it, as well as sort of a kinetic term, or there'd be a box h that appears there, there's also all sorts of interactions that are hidden in that. And so this contains much more than the spectrum. It contains all sorts of interactions. The other way I said I could do that, or I could get a similar handle on the interactions, is just by thinking about the scattering amplitudes of the Feynman diagram. But it turns out that the answers there you get aren't just simple numbers, or, we're used to calculating probably Feynman diagrams, and you get, P1s dot P2s, and maybe some more kinematic factors, and a few amplitudes that are contracted together. When you do these calculations, it turns out you get answers that are much more complicated, and you end up getting functionals of alpha prime times P1 dot P2. And so those scattering amplitudes are much more complicated than the typical Feynman diagrams that you would calculate in a field theory. And in fact, they also carry a whole infinite series. You can think that alpha prime p or p squared is small, and then you just do a Taylor series expansion of these f's. And that's equivalent to this expansion here, which was in powers of alpha prime and derivatives. It's just a Fourier transform of each other. So all of those corrections are already encoded. Say in a four-point function, that has an infinite set of alpha prime corrections hidden. Well, I didn't even tell you how to do the calculation, but if we did the calculation, it would have that infinite series already.
Okay.
Yeah.
Why do we have the string coupling appearing there? If I remember, it didn't appear in any of the actions which we wrote down before.
That's an excellent question, and we'll skip ahead and we'll answer that question. I told you that there was a string coupling, and as was pointed out, I wrote something with a G string squared. I said that this had interactions in it, but I don't see any G strings anywhere in that calculation. So, did I lie to you? No. there's a far more interesting story. It turns out that the dilaton itself is related to the string coupling. And so, so what's the story there? Well, we had this particular term, and again, it was sort of a questionable term because at some point I was saying, well, it didn't really matter what h was, and let's set it to a constant. But if h was just a constant, this would go away. But let's think about that more carefully. So I'm going to pick out of that complicated action just this one term. And one of the things is that the convention was that the alpha prime that appeared here in the string tension, that was the string tension divided by 2. Well, the canonical normalization is to put an alpha prime here so that this expression actually has no alpha primes in it anymore. Now I'm going to think about an even simpler situation, which is let's think that phi is just some constant everywhere in my space-time. Then what I can do is I can factor it out. So I have this geometric stuff, and then I factor it out. So this is our constant dilaton. The interesting thing is that this geometric term is actually something that you might encounter in the theory, well, topology or there's some mathematical theorem that says that this is actually a topological constant. It's called the Euler character. So that integral that typically gets the name chi is called the Euler character. So if I evaluate that on a round sphere, it turns out, so if I think, rather than Minkowski signature world sheets, I think of Euclidean world sheets now. If I evaluate that on a round sphere, what I find is that the answer is 2. However, I can deform the sphere. I can squash it, make it look like a football, or I can stretch it out. It turns out it doesn't matter what metric I choose on the sphere, I always get the same answer, 2. That's why this is a topological invariant. So that's the answer for any S two-dimensional sphere with any metric. Well, one of the things that's telling me is that, you know, locally I can flatten my world sheets out and try and make this look like 0, but there's going to be topological obstructions. There's going to be an obstruction to making, say, the world sheet, a spherical world sheet, flat everywhere. Because if R was 0 everywhere, I wouldn't get this answer. So the best I can do is make it 0 everywhere except maybe for a delta function at 1 point or something like that, or a delta function at 2 points.
Excuse me. So how does it compare to a flat metric? And so, I mean, the ratio should be 0, right?
For a flat metric, it's 0. So I'm not sure. Let me see if I answer your question. What I can do here is
I can think that what I've done there by introducing external string states is I've put holes in the world sheet. So in some sense, if I sealed up all of those holes, that would have been a spherical metric or a sphere. By introducing external states, I'm punching holes in that sphere. And so this answer changes if I don't have a sphere. Rather, I get 2 minus the number of holes that I punch in to the world sheet. And so, for example, the simplest case would have been just our free string. We would have had a cylinder. So there's a hole at the top, a hole at the bottom, so I'd have 2 minus 2, and that's 0. And so then there's no obstruction to R being 0 everywhere, and, well, you know that on a cylinder, it's not hard to find. Well, implicitly, we were doing that over there. On the other hand, I can, so this would be, well, I'm going to have a messy diagram. So that would give me chi equals 0. But then, you know, if I wanted to mock something up like that, I could add an extra particle here. And what that would do is it'd add another hole, and so there'd be a change in the Euler character of minus 1. If I added, you know, yet another particle to have some other external state here, there'd be another delta chi equals minus 1. And so every time I punch a hole, I'm getting, you know, that integral changes by minus 1. Or alternatively, every time I introduce an extra external state, or every time I add an interaction to this picture, I get a delta chi equals minus 1. So if I evaluate, so now I'm thinking in the Euclidean, so e to the minus, so this is in my two-dimensional path integral, my Polyakov path integral, if I'm in the Euclidean, I'm evaluating e to the minus world sheet action, well, I'm only going to think about this term. What I'm going to have is e to the minus, I'll say it's e to the plus phi naught, but the power here is the number of interactions. So we started with chi equals 0. Every time we did an external interaction, we added an extra line like this or branch like this. We got a delta chi equals minus 1. There's a minus sign here. Cancel that minus sign there. And so I get this expression coming from here. And then there's just an extra number, this topological invariant, that counts the number of interactions on my world sheet. But that's precisely what I said the role of the string coupling was up there. Every time I introduce an interaction, or the idea up there that was originally developed independent sort of this kind of thinking was that there's a G string that appears every time I have an interaction. And so what we can see here is that this quantity, the exponential of phi, is in fact the coupling constant of the theory. So the coupling constant, well, the coupling is actually dynamical in string theory. And, yeah?
Why did we switch to the Euclidean?
It's the usual thing you, well, one excuse is it's the usual thing you do in quantum field theory. What was I doing? I was doing two-dimensional quantum field theory. It is far more, well, for this discussion, it's a far more convenient framework to be talking about.
Coupling is actually dynamically mean. Phi is not a constant.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say.
So why did you take phi not a constant?
because to make this identification, I went to the simplest situation. If phi isn't a constant, then what I get here is some complicated mess. But that's because I shouldn't be thinking in terms of a coupling constant. So in particular, so what did we say? So it's dynamical when we allow, phi naught rather than being constant becomes phi of x. But what that means is if I'm in a space-time with some interesting profile like this, if I, in particular, if there are regions where, the phi has a smaller value, say in the middle of the space-time, then the strings will interact less there. Most of the interactions will take place somewhere else. In particular, if there's another spot over here where phi is really big, most of the interactions appear, are happening over there. Another comment is that, if we're thinking about asymptotically flat space, it's traditional, actually, to define a coupling constant which you associate with the asymptotic value of phi. So that's the sense in which people still talk about coupling constants in string theory in this more general sense. What they mean is the asymptotic value, e to the asymptotic value of phi. But it's really e to the phi that controls these interactions or the strength of these interactions. And so it depends where you are in the space-time, really, to say how strongly the strings are.
So can I have one more question? So, what is the rule to write down this Voorchies action, this generalization of this Polyakov's action? So you want everything which is linear in the new fields, or why don't you write B mu nu square?
I could, What I'm really doing is not, when you look at this, what you're really doing is not focusing on this, but you're focusing on this. So if I wrote down B mu nu squared, I assume you mean something like B mu alpha, B mu alpha.
Okay, mu nu contracted as well.
Let's do it this way. You can do the other one, then I'd have to walk down the board over there. But if I wrote something down like this, then I've got a symmetric tensor. And so I have to contract it with something on the world sheet that's a symmetric tensor in those mu nu indices. And so in some sense, I would, subsume that into this expression. Or in fact, there are other terms we could write down where I have two derivatives, two HABs. But it's really what we're doing is we're characterizing the world sheet operators by the number of derivatives or the dimension of those operators, and then figuring out what kind of a structure we can contract them with. I was giving you a slick sales job that didn't say any of that, but you could imagine that at the end of the day, this tensor isn't genu nu, but after we work hard and we see it appearing like this, we realize that this really is, or I should think of this as the space-time metric. But one thing I mentioned is, I've written this down, but why can't I write down some other interaction that is just, we can't call it phi. Phi hat of x. That's an operator. It lives, it's a potential for the x's. The dimensions are different, so I have to stick in a 1 over alpha prime. I could go ahead and I can do a beta function analysis with that, and I just find out that in fact this isn't the dilaton. This is actually associated with the tachyon up here. So there is an operator on the world sheet that's associated with this state, there are operators on the world sheet that are associated with all of these things. Why did I focus on these? Well, it's the past experience, the people who died for our sins. You know, if you did this, you would find that you could do some kind of expansion like this. But the expansion would have a constant term in it, you know, reflecting the fact that m squared is of the order of the string scale squared. And so what that means is that the dacyon, if I try and do that, it has derivatives, or it's varying. It has to be on shell. It has to be varying very, very quickly. And so this alpha prime expansion doesn't make any sense, or wouldn't make any sense. And so that's why we focus our attention on these massless fields.
But it's like a first order approximation when you have these background fields, or is it the most general? It's not the most general thing. So
I would say this is the most general thing that I can write down, where I get a finite set of terms here in the trace anomaly, where I can interpret those terms consistently in the framework of an alpha prime expansion. Is that enough caveats or legalese for you? There are lots of other terms I can write down, and I could extend that calculation, and I'd extend this calculation, and things would get all mixed up, and I'd give new names to the other fields, but I would find unless I turn off all those other fields, or turn off all those other operators, that I'm not going to be able to consistently solve the whole set of these beta functions in this alpha prime. I couldn't just think about things that are slowly varying on the string scale.
That's a hard question. So you wrote this based on the closed string.
Yeah.
What about the open string? I mean, the open string has also the vector process.
So sorry? The open string has a massless vector. And
would you add something?
Sorry?
Would you have to add something to this action?
Yeah, and so the thing is that implicitly what I was thinking about here was closed geometries or the holes, the only edges or boundaries that I wanted, that I've talked about so far were associated with asymptotic states. The what we're talking about now is the open string, and so I should think about string world sheets, you know, that have real boundaries on them. And where these are just intervals now, it's not a cylinder. And so there are extra boundary terms that you can add. And so in particular, there's a boundary term that I'm going to forget. But I want an AMU here, and it is del n sub a, so there's a normal vector. So again, on the boundary, there's again a new set of operators that I can write down. And there's a new set of, you know, I can make it interacting. And there's a new set of tensors or potentials that I can add there. And those start to tell me about open string fields. And, you know, again, there's, if I write out all the legalese, typically we're only interested in this contribution because it's the massless, it's the one that gives us the massless field. There was another, yeah.
Derivatives in X, I mean, for example, always in the B term, for example.
What else do you want to suggest?
Well, I guess if you choose some kind of other thing.
So I could write that down by itself. But if I wrote that down, what I said is I want some geometric structure that I can contract the indices with. If I've got a closed world sheet, there's not naturally anything with one index. Over here, I had a boundary, and so there was a normal vector. And so that let me get away with it here. So, but we're not finished. We could write down, you know, two derivatives like that. You know, I could contract that with an h. Well, I'd actually do it in a covariant way. I'd make this a covariant derivative. Have you done gr? Yeah, okay. So I want to have a covariant derivative there, so there's some extra h stuff. and I could contract that with an HAV. And this would just become Dellin-Derschen squared of x mu, and I'd write down some p mu. So I write down something like that, and then I'd say, though, well, one of the things I'd say is, okay, well, that's, you know, I can integrate by part. So then that would become del A mu, del, well, okay, it was H A B, del, del B of P mu, which becomes then derivative of mu, mu, derivative of mu, P mu, because that was a function of x. And so now this term looks like factor. And so I could subsume that into this. And I could quit there, but I'll just say, since we brought it up, there's an interesting story about this term, because that actually looks like a diffeomorphism. It's basically, it looks like how this thing changes under coordinate transformation. And so there's a story about diffeomorphisms, and you know, it's not a story I'm going to say, but you could. It has to do with things like this and total derivatives, or changing the action by total derivatives. So that's one example. We could play similar games. The main thing that I could do that would be really distinct is I could write down, say, things like x nu. But now these operators have a higher dimension. They have more derivatives. So you would find, you know, you can write down an operator like that, and it's associated with some tensor that's a function of x. And this is what I was telling David. We could go through this story. We could find a contribution like that here. But at the end of the day, what we would find is that the tensor is actually a massive field. So that's a field that's going to have a mass of the order of 1 over LF, and so if I solve its equation of motion, it means that it's varying very rapidly on the string scale. And so I couldn't properly do an expansion like that. So again, there is a more complicated story, and this kind of thing at some level captures the entire spectrum of the string. But I'm going to focus my attention on these fields. Because they're the ones that it makes sense to talk about them at low energies or varying slowly. That's the technical thing. But I also gave this hint that last day I said that the string scale, or these masses, are all out at the Planck scale. And so the interesting physics for us is actually going to be this state here. And so that's why we... Typically, we focus our attention on the massless fields. There are people who have studied. I mean, I'm telling you things that I know because other people have studied these problems. And so people have studied them, but in the end, they decided they're not so interesting. Yes?
I didn't want to ask this, but I mean, when you mentioned the one that had massive terms, could you have something that has relevant couplings in? So say...
Well, the
dilaton times something that has dimension two, so to fix it. So not the Ricci tensor.
No, but the one that we wrote down here.
No, so something that has proper dimensions too. So say LS squared.
But that was the tachyon. It corresponds to a relevant operator, but that's the only one. Clearly, we're never going to get to the other. The only other thing I wanted to embellish this story a little bit. I mentioned that let's do it here. We're also allowed to add handles or loops to these diagrams. But you can imagine I can embellish this by adding a branch here, but not sending it off to infinity. But I can bring it back to join the world sheet. And so that's something that we would call a handle. And so there are two interactions, and it adds sort of a loop or a handle to the geometry. And so this formula actually gets embellished by saying that there's another set of contributions that come from adding loops or handles. But in fact, there's a factor of two here, which coincides with the idea that there are actually two interactions. But it's also true of the mathematics that a handle contributes a minus two to this ordering variance. But that's, again, in keeping with the idea that the string coupling, well, counts interactions, and so it becomes a loop counting parameter. For instance, in QED, higher order loops come with higher order powers of alpha. I'll just write here that also count the number of loops and a string world diagram. Since we've gone down this road, we can also introducing you to some jargon, because it may come up some other place. But what I wrote down there, G mu nu, so the jargon is that this is called the string frame metric. And that starts because it's the metric that appeared here on the world sheet, or in my world sheet action. That's why it's called the string frame metric. But there are two perhaps annoying, there's one. So that's one property appears in the world sheet action. But there's this annoying property that I said, I called that R up there the Einstein term. But in fact, it's not quite the Einstein action in that there's the square root of G R, but then there's this annoying scalar field sitting in front of the Einstein term. And so what you would find is that these fluctuations that I promised you were gravitons, that there's actually a trace mode in that metric, or in the graviton in that action that couples to phi. So that's, it's kind of, well, it's just a complication. There's an e to the minus 2 phi. 2 phi in front Einstein term when I'm working in string frame. And so sometimes what people do is they want to get rid of, you know, it's more convenient to work with something that really looks like the Einstein action, and they'd like to get rid of that. And you can do that by going to something called the Einstein frame metric, because we're making a nice Einstein action up there. And what one does is you take this string frame metric, so the S here, and you do a conformal transformation by e to the, some power e to the alpha phi. And then there's the Einstein metric. And it's a good homework assignment problem, but I'll tell you the answer anyway, that if I choose that alpha there, that this is just some constant. If I choose alpha to be 4 over d minus 2, so d for us, well, I just chose 26 already, the critical dimension, but what that does is it ensures no d minus 2 pi in the Einstein term of our action. So that's just a So this is something you may run into somewhere in discussions of string theory. There's a string frame metric, an Einstein frame metric. What people are doing is they do some kind of transformation or shift of the metric. And if you do that, then the action really looks like, you know, an Einstein term, square root of gr. Something else that happens is if you think about that del phi squared by itself, it's actually a kinetic term with the wrong sign. Turns out. But after you do this transformation, the dilaton has a right sign kinetic term. And there are also e to the phi's that, you know, we cancel it in the Einstein term, but there are extra e to the phi's floating around in the rest of the action. So it looks a little bit different. And the thing is that now the graviton in that theory really is a, you know, spin two field, which is a means the polarization tensors are symmetric but also traceless. And so that frame is actually implicitly the frame that appears when you analyze the theory in this sort of perturbative picture where you calculate Feynman diagrams and you calculate scattering amplitudes. And there was one other thing. Well, there are many other things that I wanted to say. So what we said over there is the dilaton plays a special role. But I also wanted to say that the B field plays a special role as well. So some comments on the B field. And here I'll start with an analogy, which is to think about point particles. You may have seen in a GR course or in your GR course, you know, when you talk about particles moving around in a curved space-time, you give them one way to derive the geodesic equation is to think about world line action. And so I'm just going to write it as, you know, what you do is you extremize an action that depends on the proper length or the proper time. So this is a particle world line action. So that's kind of analogous to the kind of thing that we were doing that I just erased, where now we have extended objects with strings, and they have world sheet actions, or it's, you know, two-dimensional, instead of lines, you get sigma and tau. But one of the things that sometimes people discuss here, it's kind of analogous to this, but you talk, rather than particles moving around just in the space-time, you talk about charged particles. So if I add a charge here, the way you compensate or you embellish this world line action is you add a new term that's proportional to the charge. But what is the charge? What does the charged particle interact with? It interacts with a Maxwell field. A four vector or a d vector field. So there's an a nu. What do you write down? You know, there's a free index there. Well, what one writes down is tau derivative of x mu dot. So this again kind of looks like the kinds of things we're writing there. But this is what I would do if I wanted to study, say, charged black hole or charged particles propagating around a charged black hole or I don't know, through some interesting electromagnetic field. So this is the interaction of particle with an external medium field. So remember, there's a potential here. When I talk about an electromagnetic field, though, what I do is I take the exterior derivative, or I take some derivatives of that, and I write down a field strength, which is an anti-symmetric tensor. And there's so I'm lazy. I'm just going to say that A is the potential, and there's a two-index tensor. Anti-symmetric, and so in form language it looks like this. I take the exterior derivative, and there is a, there is a gauge invariance here. If you shift a mu by a derivative of something, then the electromagnetic field or the field strength is invariant. So there's a And one of the things we might note is that, well, if this A mu was actually the derivative of a scalar, then this term would just, so that would say there is no external field. This is saying there's a trivial electromagnetic field. But if I think about this action, what that would turn into is d tau, d del mu, lambda, d tau of x mu. So this is a space-time derivative. That's a world sheet derivative. But I can rewrite that as d tau, a world sheet derivative of this function, i.e. it's a total derivative. And so it goes away. It returns into boundary terms. Maybe I should put my cues here. But what that says then is that this has a remarkable property that here what I did is I said, let's look at a trivial field. And in fact, for trivial or gauge trivial fields, there is no interaction here. This is a complicated way to write nothing. But it's also in more general, if I have a certain A and I shift it, or I want to compare it to an A that's just different by a total derivative, I could play the same game, and what I would see is that the interactions of my charged particle are independent of the gauge, or don't depend on these gauge transformations. And so this particular action captures, I told you it was the right action, but it captures this feature of gauge field. Why am I telling you all that? Oh, the last thing I'm supposed to tell you is there's a charge associated with that. There's also a charge So this is just a fancy way of saying what I do is I integrate the electric field flux on the sphere at infinity. That gives me the charge. But in particular, what you would find is that this particle sources the electromagnetic field in a way that it contributes a charge Q to that quantity there. So that's exactly. Well, I'll pause there. Are we happy with all of that? We're relatively happy with all that. It's getting late.
Sorry.
Yeah.
How did you go from the left-hand side of that equation to the right-hand side, where you substituted for A?
Which one? This one?
Yes.
All I did is I said, just imagine this is the case. And I substituted that into that.
But
oh.
Did you do integration by parts?
Oh, you mean to go from here to here?
Yes.
No, that's just whoever's rule. Leibniz rule? I'm taking a derivative with respect to tau of x, but here I'm taking a derivative with respect to x of lambda. So that just it, or well, maybe it's easier to do the other way around. If I take the tau derivative of some function of x, what I'm going to do is I'm going to vary lambda with respect to x first, and then I'm going to take the derivatives of x. Yes? No?
I'm not sure.
Lambda is equal to the
chain rule. Sorry, I got the wrong button.
Okay.
Yeah.
That makes
sense. Okay. Go try it. Why did I tell you that story? Well, there's. I was telling you that there's an analogy with that B field up there. I was saying that B is kind of like an A field, but it has two indices. And so when I make the field strength, it becomes a field strength with three indices. But that H, you know, again, there's a similar language. F equals dA, H equals dB. But what do I see? What is that coupling up there? Well, that's actually, well, I guess I didn't write that one. So, I can think of this, again, by chain rule or whatever. I can think that what I've got here is Q times the integral of the one-fourth, yeah, okay, maybe I'm cheating. I mean, I can think of this expression in terms of, say, some nice geometric expression using this language of form. And the claim is that that expression up there that has a b mu nu is the analogous two-index version of this. Here I've got a one-index object coupling to a world line or an object that has one, or yeah, a geometric object that has one dimension, namely time. There I've got a two-index object, b mu nu, coupling to, again, a geometric object, but it's a world sheet that has two directions. And so there's an analogous, or the analogy extends there. So the B mu nu coupling to the string world is a natural extension of this charge coupling. It's perhaps an interesting exercise to show that there's actually a gauge invariance there that's associated with shifting b mu nu by the derivative of a vector in the same way that here there's a gauge invariance. And what you can show is that that coupling there, if you make that kind of substitution, that again becomes a total derivative, which just turns into boundary terms. And so that coupling is invariant under that gauge invariance. The last thing which I just threw out here was that there's a charge and that these particles source the electromagnetic field through this particular coupling. But in the same way, it turns out then that the strings our charge objects with respect to B mu nu. And so there would be a similar formula. Well, I can write it down. That there'd be a charge which would be the integral of the star of H around an extended string like that. And so I'll ask, let's imagine I had a theory of membranes which were extended not in one spatial direction, but extended in two spatial directions. What do you think the natural extension would be? What would that theory of membranes naturally be a theory, or what would it naturally couple to?
A higher form.
Yeah. So can you do the counting for me? How many indices?
Three.
There you go. So something we'll see apparently next day is that in general, you know, if I have forms with some number of indices, they naturally couple to a world sheet or a world volume where the dimension of that world volume is precisely the number of indices on the form. And we'll see next day that string theory naturally gives us forms like that, but it also naturally gives us objects that are extended in more dimensions. So string theory, it turns out, is not just a theory of string. So that's just a prelude. Well, I'll just mention it. So everything we talked about so far, this theory, this Polyakov path integral, where all I was doing was mapping the world sheet into space-time, or even interesting space-times up there, but the only real variables of the field in the quantum two-dimensional quantum field theory were these x mu's. Those were scalars. And so this is called the bosonic string. So if we put together all our buzzwords, we were talking about a relativistic critical bosonic string. It had a couple of shortcomings that we noted along the way. One was that the ground state was actually a tachyon. So that was unfortunate. When we think of this as a space-time theory and those strings propagating around in the space-time, the first thing that naturally popped out at us was something with a negative mass to it. Well, actually, that was the second thing that popped out at us. I guess the first thing that popped out at us was that the critical dimension was 26, which seems to be an excess of riches. This actually isn't so much a problem. And I'll tell you why, because if it had turned out that D was equal to 4, I would have been able to tell you right away that this is the wrong theory. Because what I said is that this theory is characterized by two things, one coupling and one scale, the string scale. But if I look around in nature, I see that there are lots of different couplings. And in fact, there are lots of different scales that are relevant in particle physics or in nature in general. And so what we'll see later, well, actually, we're not going to see that, but if you take a more extended string theory course, what you find is that it's an essential feature of the theory that it have higher dimensions, because it's by engineering the extra dimensions, by engineering this excess, that you can actually introduce different couplings or different scales into the theory. I mean, they're extra geometric scales. But that's an aside. Another shortcoming that we haven't mentioned so far, but since I'm saying that what we want to talk about is the world that we observe, one of the things we see in this world are fermions. And this had no fermions in it, and so this isn't going to be able to do the job. So there's nothing that looks like an electron or a proton. In some sense, what we have is, we had gauge fields, or we had one forms, we had gauge fields, we had a graviton. So we had, in this model, the force mediators that we need for particle physics, but we don't have the matter fields. We don't have the electrons, we don't have whatever, the muons, tauons, quarks, whatever. And so we're going to have to try harder. But this was still a useful exercise to pick up a lot of the characteristics of these first quantized strings. And I think what I'll do is I'll just quit there. But next day what we'll try and do is I'll try and give you a gist of fermionic string theory. It's not worth trying to do that for 5 minutes. So if there are no questions, we're done. Any questions? No questions. Okay. So I need a sheet that has names and emails, and I need a sheet that has lectures on it. Okay, thank you.